Yep, let's go.
It's 1:30. We're now back in session. We're moving into agenda item 7, Columbia River Salmon Fishery Policy C-3620. This is a decision. Mr. Twight and Mr. Lothrop.
Good afternoon, Chair Carpenter, Commissioners, and Director Sussman, Deputy Director Windrup. I'm Bill Twight with the Fish Program, and with me is Ryan Lothrop, also the Fish Program. We're from the Columbia River Management Unit. We're here to provide some last-minute information that is essential for you as you contemplate a final decision on this matter of policy. So the one part of our information that's not mentioned in the presentation that Ryan's about to provide is that we were able to, with considerable help from our SEPA rules coordinator, we were able to get the SEPA analysis finished yesterday. And so we'll also describe the outcome of that SEPA determination. So with that, let me turn it over to Ryan.
Good afternoon, Chair, Commissioners, Director. So the SEPA analysis is essentially an addendum to the current SEPA analysis for Columbia River Policy C-3620. Pardon me as I look at the number. It is addendum 20-044 to DNS 12-084. So it's revisions to the current SEPA process and was distributed to effective parties, counties, yesterday afternoon. Largely, it is just what is the change from the existing policy that we have in place under that previous SEPA analysis to the proposed Columbia River Work Group recommendation. And so the synopsis is that there is a minor reduction in recreational angler trips while still above the base period, and an increase to commercial ex vessel value. That is, the simplest way to characterize the difference. Obviously, there are differences between what is the original policy versus the work group recommendation, and that is essentially switching to abundance-based matrices for the spring and summer Chinook allocations. Fall Chinook would revert from the 80-20 to the 70-30 allocation, and additional flexibility on gear types by time and location. Kind of keeping this high level because we walked through it several times before, but that's the genesis of the difference between the original SEPA analysis to the current addendum under review as we move forward in time. So I'll pause there and see if there's any questions or anything else Bill what needs to fill in that I might have missed. So Chair, I don't believe I have anything more on the SEPA, but staff is here. If there are questions, we can help answer those.
Any questions from the commission? Hearing none, do you have more information, Bill or Ryan? Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Commissioner McIsaac.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Maybe we can start the dialogue with a motion. So I will show a motion on the screen. And that motion is that I move to adopt the public review draft containing revisions to policy C-3620 as by the red font language changes brought forward at the September 1 commission workshop and contained in the third agenda materials on the website for this agenda item. And if I can, if the motion is seconded, I will show that language on the Zoom screen to be sure we're all clear on what the motion means.
I'll second it.
Second by Commissioner Kehoe.
Okay. Well, so let me first go through the language changes. We talked about this at the September 1st workshop, but let me go through them again. So the motion would be to adopt the public review draft as it stands with these changes. Red font meaning inserted language, and yellow and strikeout meaning deleted language. So it reorganizes and numbers the three purposes that have been in the purpose statement before, to include the word preservation. So it would say achieves conservation, preservation, recovery, protection, and preservation goals for Columbia Sound Steelhead. Yes. Yes.
I recall in the last discussion that Commissioner Linville provided some comment, I believe, on the word preservation and the negative connotations that it has in some arenas. Did you have a chance to research that or look into it, or?
No, yes, I sure did. And I would like to speak to that again, maybe as a process, if I could go through, just to be clear for the commissioners again, what this proposes, then I would like to come back and speak specifically to preservation, recovery, and the geographic language as well, and say a little bit about why these changes are being made.
Okay.
I have the other spot later that I'd like to go through. And again, it's a reiteration for those of us at the September workshop, say what it is so we're all clear on what's in the motion and say a little bit about why. Then I'd like to actually speak to the whole motion. And we heard testify this morning that there hasn't been a lot of policy justification for things. So I'd like to put a few things on the record. And I'd kind of like to go through all of that and then take questions at the end, if that works for you. Yeah. Okay. So in point number two, which has to do with the economics of the economics purpose in a manner that does not impair the resource. And so this would be in a manner that does not impair the resource and maintains the economic well-being and stability of the fishing industry in the state by enhancing and improving both recreational and commercial fishing, including geographic distribution of fishing opportunities. And the third one, changing the word from conduct to promotes. So working backwards on this, promotes is verbatim from the RCW that is the mandate of the commission. Preservation is in the mandate of the commission. I'll speak to that in a moment. Does not impair the resource is a phrasing that is verbatim out of the RCW. Taking the word geographic out of here puts this to a point of being essentially verbatim from the RCW, that is the mandate to deal with the economic well-being and stability of the fishing industry in the state. And improving both recreational and commercial fishing, again, is straight out of the RCW, and I'll show you that in a moment. The geographic distribution of fishing opportunities is not, and I think we need to put something on the record as to why that's in there. Getting back to preservation, the concern that was brought up by Commissioner Linville is the common use in some arenas that preserve means conservation with no use. And conservation means conservation with some use. And the RCW doesn't actually have footnotes that specify that, but it is of some common use in the world of wildlife management. And in the old days, we heard that even in some fishery management areas. So I do think that it's appropriate to put the word preservation in here because it's in our mandate, but I don't mean it in this motion to mean preservation with no use. I mean it to be preservation in a different sense, such as if we preserve genetic resources of salmon by being careful in our hatchery practices. That's not a no-take situation, but that is the kind of preservation that I mean. I didn't speak in September about this word perpetuation too much. That is in our mandate as well. And I think this is an important word when it gets down to the idea of making for more salmon, to perpetuate the salmon in the Columbia River at a higher level of abundance. And that is one of the policy directives. So just very quickly, let me show again the mandate of the department and some of this keywording. Shall preserve, protect, and perpetuate is there. The department in economics, the department shall seek to maintain the economic well-being and stability of the fishing industry in the state. And the department shall promote and shall enhance and improve recreational fishing in the state. So I just remember, this is the mandate of the department of the commission, and I think it's important to have that in the purpose statement. The geographic distribution of opportunities is not. This wording was discussed with our legal counsel, and he indicated, as he's done in the past, that if we're going to deviate in a policy matter from the kind of verbatim language, it's good to say why and get that on the record. And the Columbia River Work Group had a lot of talk about geographic distribution being a positive policy thing to advocate for up and down the river from Ilwaco to the headwaters. And so that is why this was voted on at the Columbia River Work Group, and I'm including it here and want to emphasize that this is an additional policy direction, not in RCWs, but coming from the commission if this is adopted for that purpose. Let me scroll down to the second matter that was spoken of in September, which is the other deviation from the public review draft. And it has to do with in the fishery specific provisions, where previously under spring Chinook salmon, under summer Chinook salmon, under fall Chinook salmon, there was a continual phrasing for allowable commercial gear that talked about including both gillnets and any alternative gear which could be used. And the intent had been that it would be used if it was more selective, but the draft did not say that. And so you'll see here, adding the sentence that regarding the allowable commercial fishing gear, the department through its seat on the Columbia River Compact shall strive to adopt concurrent fishing, commercial fishing regulations with the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife that optimize time, area, and mesh size restrictions using gillnet, tangle net, beach seine, purse seine, pound net, and or other alternative commercial fishing gear towards a goal of selectively harvesting healthy hatchery and wild stocks while protecting weak stocks and minimizing bycatch. And as was said in September, this is meant to be policy direction to the person in that seat to strive for the most selective gear. And if that happens to be tangle net that is more selective than gill net, either in the spring Chinook time frame or the early coho time frame, then this would be policy direction to do that. And as we transition to and move toward more selective alternative gear, if there is gear that performs better than a gillnet in terms of time, area, and mesh size alternatives, then the direction would be to use that. It keeps gillnet as one of the tools in the toolbox, but has a policy direction to be as selective as possible. So that, to be clear, is the motion to adopt all of this with these changes. And I would like to take a moment and go through some justification for the new policy. And I'm going to go ahead and get off of this screen so that we can see each other. And again, if I can just run through this and take questions later, I would prefer that. And I want to start off by saying thanks to all the good work from the staff on this. Our attorneys advise us that review and update of policies are good business, and this particular policy specifically called for it to occur, and the staff has just done a very stellar job enabling a serious policy review.
Don, is Dave. Did you want me to hold off on my amendment until you've addressed this, or is this the appropriate time so we can consider the entire package?
Yes, what I would prefer is to put on the record some points that justify the motion that I'm being made and have some questions of the motion being made. And then when that's over, you have an amendment to propose that we would move to the amendment.
Very good, Don. I just wanted to be clear. Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. In terms of complimenting the staff over the course of 2 years, they have supported the old PRC meetings and also the Columbia Workgroup meetings superbly, documenting the agendas, the analysis, the meeting summaries, all of that posted promptly on the website for everybody to see. And so they've just done a very nice job. And again, I'd like to put some justification on the record. I know our legal counsel is always giving advice about building the record. And I think some of the folks who have testified who haven't heard some of the policy justification, and for commissioners who might be voting on this to hear it as well. So I'd first like to say what I took out of the evaluation that I felt deserved a response, and then say what this new policy language does to provide a response. And then there's several new ideas that came up during the process that I'd like to highlight as well. So the analytical results showed that various key initiatives were not achieved. Perhaps the most significant was the failure to achieve one of the three purposes, the three parts of the purpose statement at the onset of the old policy, that was to, quote, maintain or enhance the economic well-being and stability of the commercial fishing industry in the state. The analysis showed that the commercial fishery had severe economic reductions after normalizing for variable run size and price per pound parameters. There was a reduction of over 30% to the commercial fishery when the Oregon off-channel catches are included, and a reduction of over 50% in the main stem and Washington off-channel economic value. Regarding the sport fishery, the report concluded, quote, after standardizing the data for total salmon returns to the Columbia Basin, the annual number of angler trips in the main stem fisheries downstream of Bonneville Dam decreased overall during the post-policy period, despite a slight increase in total fishing days. There were other significant policy shortfalls, including the failure to transition the commercial fishery to more selective alternative gear, the failure to find off-channel areas where the commercial fishery could selectively harvest hatchery fish in the state of Washington, the failure to enhance hatchery production, and the failure to conduct a buyback program for commercial fishing licenses. These economic purpose failures are noteworthy in that the old plan provided four conditions in the adaptive management section, calling for a response if the risks to the commercial fishery turned out negative, all four of which did. The last sentence in the executive summary of the evaluation states simply, the expectations and the development of the policy were not met. So what should we do about a response? And the work group wrestled with this, and this new policy language addresses the shortcomings of the old policy, I think, in a very responsible, positive way. The economic performance shortcomings are addressed by changing the allocation to the halfway point in the old policy, corresponding to the time when a transitional leap from gillnet gear to more selective gear was to have occurred, 2016. The effects of this change were not large, to a 70-30 allocation from an 80-20. If alternative gear had been implemented successfully, there would have been the 80-20. The effect on the recreational fishery was softened by including an abundance-based allocation matrices for springs and summers to provide the 80-20 sharing to the sport fishery when run sizes are low, again, for springs and summer Chinook. The other part that's responsible is to call for enhanced hatchery production that didn't occur in the off-channel areas and have better economics to both sport and commercial fisheries upstream from that point, so long as these increased hatchery releases are in areas safe to wild fish. Regarding the failure to develop and implement more selective alternative fishing gear and its consequent failure on the PHAS challenge, the new policy contains a new approach and stronger language. It's in testimony this morning. Please don't roll back the previous advancements in selective fishing. There are no rollbacks here on selective fishing pursuit. The language is actually stronger. It calls for the commercial fishery to be engaged in a different way that I think it has a better chance of success. Regarding the failure of the commercial fishing license buyback program, the new policy calls for a bi-state policy committee to develop equitable recommendations to both states. And this is something very similar to the language used by the governor in his budget veto rationale. Regarding the lack of off-channel areas in Washington's geography where hatchery supplementation was to occur, the new policy calls for hatchery enhancement in areas where it can be done while, quote, grossly minimizing the genetic and ecological risks to wild populations. And there are some spots in the Columbia where that can happen. So I think it would not be responsible to decline doing something in response to this comprehensive evaluation that demonstrated some shortcomings and would also be contrary to the adaptive management section of the old policy. What about the new approaches and new ideas that came up? There are spots in here where right off the get-go at the purpose statement, we're grounding this better in RCW 77040012, the mandate of the commission. I think that improves and advances the conservation and management of the policy directives. And there are a short list here of improvements that I think fall into the conservation policy category. But let me say, first of all, on the strongest thing you can do on conservation, with a capital C on conservation, is to prevent overfishing. And let's be clear, there is not any improvement to the conservation obligation of preventing overfisheries in this new version because they are already fully met in a scientifically based ESA limitation approach in the past. We've done a good job on that in the past. And just to be clear, this is not going to do any better than the past because the past has been successful. But let's be clear, there's no added fishing pressure causing overfishing. All the fish caught are going to be counted. All the fish released are going to be counted or estimated with the best available science. And using gillnet gear will not cause a problem with regard to overfishing or the big C of conservation. Maybe in terms of some smaller Cs that can add up to things, calling for more selective alternative fishing gear will improve the conservation of genetic resources by improving PHAS. There's a policy initiative for consideration of thermal refugia in this new policy with the state of Oregon. We talked about that a little bit more. And that's a conservation measure linked to these elevated water temperatures we're seeing. Later, after Commissioner Graybill is done, I hope to have the commission entertain a slight amendment that could maybe strengthen the climate change references in here. This policy has a brand new policy guideline advancing the conservation of non-ESA listed salmon and steelhead populations. There was no such guideline in the old policy. And we note that summer Chinook salmon on the Columbia River are not ESA listed. And there's some strong language there to help that and other strong healthy stocks. There's conservation language in two locations regarding the emphasis for hatchery enhancements to be done in a manner that grossly minimizes the genetic and ecological impacts. There's policy direction for conservation for southern resident killer whales by accommodating initiatives to increase their preferred prey. So there are several new conservation benefits that may not be as big as the strongest arm on preventing overfishing, but I think they're significant. There are some other new things in here that aren't in the conservation bailiwick but that are worth mentioning. Maybe a biggest one here is the strong policy emphasis to make the pie bigger for both sport and commercial fisheries. And I've said before, this is in recognition that the more people that are interested in salmon, the better off the salmon will be. When it comes to argue for habitat protection and for better scientific practices in fishery management, the more people we have behind us, the better. So there's a specific policy advocation for a higher abundance of both hatchery and natural fish, more natural fish from reintroductions above dams as per the Columbia Basin Partnership Task Force report, such as above Grand Coulee Dam. more hatchery fish, including for southern resident killer whale conservation reasons, where it can be done safely, and more natural fish from some strong habitat improvement policy directions. There's also policy advocation to the principle of living up to mitigation promises for lost salmon runs due to impassable dams and permanently degraded habitat from the federal hydropower system in particular. This should make for more salmon in the long run. There's a stronger emphasis on improving the science. So if we need more monitoring in the commercial fishery, if we need better catch and release estimates in the sport fishery, there's language to get better on the science. There's a policy direction dealing with the unlimited sport guide entry into the fishery in a concurrent manner with Oregon authorities. And lastly, in closing that out, I'd like to just say that the new policy has been developed in a lengthy, open, and transparent process where all policy options that were brought forward were entertained. We had ample opportunity for public testimony, and all was well documented, as I mentioned earlier. So all in all, in my opinion, this is a very positive plan that does a lot of good things. What would not be positive and would not be responsible would be to ignore the 5-year comprehensive evaluation results and ignore these new ideas that have come forward and do nothing. I know in September we talked a little bit about concurrency of policies and regulations with Oregon, and Commissioner Baker brought that up earlier this morning, so let me just say just a few words on that. Should this motion pass, I think we should have more specific discussions of the next steps engaging Oregon towards the final goal of concurrent regulations and policy directions, and do that under this agenda item. However, I'd like to emphasize that I think this goal is something that can be achieved. We talk about concurrency in regulations, and we talk about concurrency in policy. And let me say that we have a long history of achieving regulatory concurrency with Oregon while we discuss policy differences. We've heard some things about, well, this is going to be a big blow to concurrency, but we've got a long history of success there. In 2019, Oregon matched Washington's regulations for the balance of the year after the March Policy Review Committee meeting and the Washington Commission meeting in March in Spokane. In early 2020, we negotiated a compromise between different policy positions for concurrent regulations for the remainder of this year. So there are many other examples over the year, since both states have a very high common regard for concurrency. And I think that is something we've demonstrated that we can achieve. I think in the same spirit, both states have mutual benefit to policy concurrency, so that implementation of policy direction can occur, as opposed to continually dealing with matters that can be the subject of rancorous stakeholder debate. And so I have a very positive prospect in my mind about getting to concurrent approaches with Oregon. But I will acknowledge that the long successful history of getting there does call for appropriate compromise when necessary to achieve this goal. So lastly, you've heard me say, what's good with this plan? What's wrong with this plan? We've heard a lot of public comment about what the people believe to be wrong with this plan, and I think that deserves just a very short response. I'm only going to speak to a couple of the criticism that we have heard, but if there are others that commissioners have on their minds, we should talk about them, consult, and make sure we're properly informed when we make a decision. We've received letters and emails stating that the public review draft, quote, returns gillnets to the Columbia River, and, quote, opens year-round gillnet fishing on the Columbia River, which will, quote, reduce sport fishing seasons by up to 25%. Unfortunately, there's a lot of misleading half-truths or outright false negative input that comes about from some of our testimony, and maybe some of it is innocent, but these kind of phrasings fall into that category of a mischaracterization. Sometimes you get the feeling that this phrasing is intentional to create the illusion that gillnet fishing gear has been banned for good reasons, and the new policy is now reintroducing it for bad reasons with bad consequences. And so with regard to reintroducing gillnets, I would note that both Washington and Oregon rules allow for gillnet fishing gear in the Columbia River. In 2020 and 2019,
terrible.
2018, and back in time. So there's no technically a return of gillnets that were out. And the claim of year-round, I won't even get into that too much because it's just, well, it's ridiculous. Sport fishing isn't even open year-round on the Columbia River. So, but we do need to use gillnets as a management tool with proper time, area, and mesh size regulations to keep the commercial fishery viable until such a time as the alternative gear proves out to be superior. A 25% reduction in sport fishing. We noticed there's very little reference to the staff analysis when we hear claims of numbers that high. And the staff has looked at the angler trip estimates for these various changes. And across all the seasons, it comes to less than 2%, with some of the smaller singular seasons maybe reaching up to 10 or 12% I saw somewhere. But overall, across the fisheries seasons, less than 2%. And that doesn't even include any increase in angler trips that I hope are coming due to the pie being bigger. So that's just not a very fair criticism. That is not a reason to vote no on the plan. The new policy, quote, abandons the old policy and its reforms and would, quote, undo efforts to enhance the conservation and selectivity of Columbia River salmon fisheries under the Oregon-Washington Columbia River reforms. Well, I won't go into detail on this one, but the new policy does not abandon the old policy. 10 of the 12 policy guidelines in the old policy are repeated in the update to this policy. The organizational structure is the same, and some of the exact wording is in place. And the updated language is actually stronger on the conservation and selectivity concepts as opposed to any claim of undoing them. The last one here, the draft policy is inconsistent with the legal requirements in place in the state of Oregon, setting the stage for a possible break in concurrent management for the first time since the Columbia River Compact was adopted in 1915. Well, there have been many instances, not none, of non-concurrent fishery regulations in the Columbia River since 1915, although not very many in the past couple of decades, maybe three decades. The fishery management policy structure was non-current at the onset of 2019. This fact and the comprehensive evaluation begat our process to work with Oregon to do something to get to concurrent policies. We're currently in a non-concurrent fishery management policy regime with Oregon. However, we negotiated a one-year compromise in effect to achieve regulatory concurrency. And as far as the statutory requirements in the state of Oregon, the state of Oregon has this almost the same obligations as are in our adaptive management section of our old plan. The 2013 engrossed Senate Bill 830 mandates almost those same kind of things. So there's not going to be management chaos on the river due to non-concurrent. That just will not occur. I'm very confident that we can reach agreement with them. So I'm not going to spend any more time on any negative characterizations. I would like to focus on the many positive parts of this policy update and answer any questions about it. I think this is a very good step forward, and it's a good new plan. So thank you, Mr. Chairman. I know that was a little windy, but I'd be glad to answer any questions. I think it was important to get some of that on the record.
Are there any questions of Commissioner McIsaac? Okay, seeing none, I think now it's Commissioner Graybill's time for comment.
Thank you, Chair. In keeping with Commissioner McIsaac's descriptions of some language changes that would be part of this draft policy that we're going to consider, on page 8 of the pre-decision draft under spring Chinook salmon, you'll find that there are some markouts there and some red that indicates a percentage change. And it's a 5% percentage change on the upriver allotment of spring salmon. This is in response to requests from not only recreational anglers, but the Snake River Salmon Recovery Board, many of the county commissioners from that region, to create what they felt would be a more equitable share of that particular resource, the spring salmon. And we wrestled with this during this process at one time. First of all, I should say, this was brought to my attention as early as 2014. And we're finally addressing it as part of the policy today. We looked at many different alliterations of potential methods of providing equity for the Snake River Basin in regard to spring Chinook. At one point, we narrowed it to 10, and then we narrowed it down to what you see here today. I suppose the primary deviation from maybe the top two options that were being considered was a fixed number of 500 spring Chinook to be transferred upriver to provide opportunity, social and economic benefit to the Snake River Basin. And actually, I felt that in lean years, when our runs were very low, that a fixed number could be onerous and would not be fair or appropriate for a lot of different reasons, conservation reasons, equity, all those things. So at least with a percentage, it will slide with the availability of fish. And so what you see here today, I would move to amend Chairman McIsaac's motion to include this paragraph that describes this allocation of spring salmon.
Commissioner Graybill?
Yes, sir.
It has been requested of me that you show your motion language on the screen. Are you able to do that?
I believe if the way that we can access that is by going to your agenda and looking under the this agenda item, and you'll see one that's marked Graybill. And that will pull this up. You may have to scroll down again to page 8 of 11.
Perhaps Nikki could show that to all of us on the screen.
Yes, maybe to do that up. Might be easier for Nikki to do that. Thank you, Commissioner Chair.
You're welcome.
Said page 8, right?
Yes.
There you go.
There we go. Thank you, Nikki. And as I said, we went through, I know Commissioner Thornburn had joined me with meetings down in the Tri-Cities area, taking public comment. We heard from county commissioners at those meetings, the Salmon Recovery Board from that region. I'm not saying this is the ultimate solution. Let me rephrase that. Is this going to make everybody happy in the Snake River Basin? No. After all considerations of a way to provide an answer to their request, this is the best solution we've arrived at with agreement with the folks with the Salmon Recovery Board and the county commissioners and all those involved. And I know that Commissioner Thornburn at our last meeting wondered where this was going to be addressed, and it is in place today. And this is in the form of an amendment, and I move that this phrase be included in the document, and if there's a second, we can have some discussion about it.
I'll second.
Okay, we have a motion by Commissioner Graybill and a second from Commissioner Thornburn on the amendment. Further discussion?
Mr. Chairman?
I can't see but you now. I don't know who else has got their hand up, but go ahead, Commissioner McIsaac, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Let me speak against the amendment, and let me just show briefly my reasons why. Nikki, I'm going to see if this will show up here. You may have to release to show this.
I did.
Okay. So I just want to quickly go over, show the data that we saw in September for my reasons why to not support the motion. So this is the table from the staff analysis showing the sharing upriver and lower river. I made the point at the workshop that a lot of these weren't out of balance. And so you'll see right now without the amendment, it's about 75-25 approximately for spring Chinook. It's heavier to upriver for summer Chinook. For fall Chinook, it's 2/3 lower river, 1/3 upriver. For wild A steelhead, it's 2-1, 60-40 favoring upriver. Wild bees, it's 80-20. So by this, I feel like in terms of looking for a spot to support the motion, I don't see it in terms of some gross inequities in terms of upriver sharing. This is the staff analysis that was mentioned the other day. If I've got it right, I'd ask Ryan to please correct me if I've got it wrong. This refers to a 500 fish transfer, but I think it's essentially the same as the motion on the table. And it shows in terms of pre-update fishing days that compared to status quo, there'd be one less day below Bonneville. And let me see if I can get this out of the way here. Some 8 additional days in the Snake River. If I've got that right, maybe I better ask Ryan to check out that one. In terms of angler trips, below Bonneville, you'd give up over 5,000 angler trips and gain about 800 in the Snake River. And in terms of kept fish, you'd give up about 900 fish in the lower river and gain about 500 in the Snake River. And those are the things that influence my leaning to not support the motion.
If I might mention, you're using the 500 fish transfer in these examples, and I said that probably wouldn't be appropriate, and that's why we're using a percentage that gives a more equitable share during lean or good years. And we did not accept the 500 fish transfer that you're describing here.
You're absolutely right about that. Let me just defer to staff to tell us, just so we know in advance, what the trade-offs are in terms of fishing days, angler trips, and kept catch. And I'm going to take this off.
Commissioner Thorburn?
Thanks, Nikki.
Is there a response? Is there a response from staff?
I was going to see if staff has any clearer numbers, and then I can make my comment.
So, Chair and Commissioners, this is Ryan. Commissioner Graybill is correct that in the sense that what is on the table is a 70-30 sharing upriver, downriver, rather than a 500 fish. However, we don't have any more precise estimates than the exercise that occurred at the 500 fish level, and that is due to the 500 fish being similar enough through the PRC process to equate to a 70-30 sharing. So in a sense, both are correct, if that makes sense. And the way Commissioner McIsaac illustrated the trade-off days for the lower river fishery, the lost day is would likely occur in the April timeframe, one of the more heavily fished time periods for the spring Chinook period. I think I recall seeing 8 days or so from the Snake River being gained by 500 fish based on run sizes that have occurred in the past. This is, again, it's not a predictive tool. It's basically an exercise walking through allocations and fishing effort that has occurred in the past with those run sizes.
So Ryan, if I may, is this something you modeled or how did you come up with this?
Chair Carpenter, in a sense, yes, we used models to help us inform what the catch balance would have been for those run sizes years, where we would do the sharing between the geography sections. Obviously, we had to inform the model effort. And you know what that translates into catch as well. So we, in a sense, we have a model for managing the upriver spring Chinook impacts collectively. However, the Snake River manager and biologists, they have their own mechanism to manage their fishery. So a model informing models, if that helps answer your question.
Well, my follow-up question, is that based on this percentage sharing that Commissioner Graybill spoke of, or was this on the 500 fish shift?
So the modeling, the analysis and associated modeling was based on 500 fish, but when you did the math, what that translates into is 70-30 sharing.
Okay. I may have another question, but thank you for that.
So can I make my comments and observations?
Yes, go ahead, Commissioner Thorburn.
And just a process question. So right now we have an amendment before us, so we're making comments about that. And then we'll vote on the amendment and then return to the full motion. And at that time, we'll discuss that because I did have my hand up when Don finished, but I wasn't clear on what the process was going to be.
I'm sorry for not recognizing you, Commissioner Thorburn. For some reason, your hand was coming up on my screen all morning, but this afternoon now, I didn't see it, so I missed you. I apologize for that.
Okay, so, but that's what the process will be. We're discussing the amendment now, and then we will, once we vote on the amendment, we'll return to the full policy. Is that policy proposal? Is that correct?
That's my understanding that that's correct. If Joe Pinesco would like to discuss that for clarity, that would be welcome.
Joe, are you gonna?
He is.
Yeah, just had to unmute. Yeah, so in terms of the parliamentary procedure, the commission has an internal policy document dated 2017. It's relatively short. It does not expressly adopt Robert's Rules of Order, but it indicates that the principles set out in that document they look to Robert's Rules of Order for those. And yeah, on this particular issue, if there is initially a motion made and seconded, and then a motion to amend, there should be discussion and a vote on the amendment first to resolve it before returning to discussion of the main original motion.
Thank you. So I'm going to support the amendment and a couple of observations. The 500 turns out to be close to 70-30, and the model, so the modeling is close. Dave did bring up that 500 is a fixed number, and it could be troublesome in low return years. And one of the things that I like about the policy revisions that are proposed is going to an abundance-based allocation. And that I think would be better recognized by the percentages that that Dave proposes in his amendment. I'm supporting this, having participated in meetings with our stakeholders up here, as well as a lot of the really thoughtful correspondence that we've received as we've gone through this process. Seems to me is the question here in allocation decisions is the Snake River is, while it's not the terminal, it's sort of the terminal fishery question. It's where the fish come from, shouldn't those fishing it have some opportunity? And I believe that this proposed amendment recognizes that it's hard to get things perfect when we're being somewhat specific in policy, which I think we need to do with allocation as we've discussed in this process. But I think honor the concerns that I've been hearing really since I've been on the commission from our stakeholders up here. That's my comment.
Pardon me, Commissioner Kehoe.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm speaking to Commissioner Graybill's. I think folks heard me during the workshop that I'm Switzerland. But there was a couple of comments in the public testimony today. One by a Mr. Highland, who I know has from Walla Walla, who's been advocating for a higher allocation to upriver for the spring Chinook, higher than the existing policy of 25%. So what I heard him say, though, was that if Commissioner McIsaac's motion were to pass, that at least the folks that Mr. Highland represents, I believe he was speaking on behalf of an organization, would oppose the motion, even with the amendment in it, increasing the upriver spring allocation. So I just maybe, since I am Switzerland on this, maybe I'd like to hear some more discussion among the commissioners about how do we resolve.
Any other commissioner comments on this? I am seeing none. Commissioner Baker, now your hand is up.
You're muted, Barbara.
Yep, just figured that out, sorry. I didn't really plan to comment on this amendment, but I believe at this point, I would be a no vote on the amendment, not for any of the fishery reasons that have been presented, but because, as you will hear when we get to final passage on this policy, I'm very concerned about concurrency. And it just seems to me that every vote we're taking makes our concurrency process more difficult and makes that mountain more difficult to climb. I'm just thinking, I certainly have no inside knowledge on how the commission or the state of Oregon feels about this, but I can't think that they will look favorably on this amendment.
Thank you, Commissioner Baker. Commissioner Thorburn, and then Commissioner Graybill, I believe. Yeah.
Commissioner Kehoe asked a question about how we respond to Mr. Highland's testimony. My feeling is we just make the decision. This is questions about allocation and how we divide up the pie. it's up to us. So that's my response, Bob.
Thank you, Commissioner Thorburn. Commissioner Grayville?
Thank you. You know, Barbara, I appreciate that, what you said about concurrency. Yes, we're going to have concurrency issues with Oregon for sure. I believe that this issue is an important one to our constituents here in Washington. And I'm not saying that it's going to pass muster with the state of Oregon, but they should have the opportunity to review it. I know that Commissioner Kehoe mentioned that the original PRC, the people that were on the PRC at that time, didn't seem to like this idea, but there's new people now in Oregon. And I'm very interested in what their opinion is on the equity of moving fish into the Snake River Basin. There was reluctance at that time with the members of the PRC about responsibility of the Columbia River as a basin and not just town, but considering policy and regulations and conservation concerns that affected the entire basin. And I'm hoping that we have a different mindset when we get to know this group from Oregon. And I believe it's important that the people that supported this and brought this concept forward get the opportunity to have it fully vetted.
Anyone else? Commissioner Anderson, looks like you're warming to speak. There you are.
Yeah, I'm trying to figure it out. I am affected by the purpose statement with regard to the geographic distribution of fishing opportunities. And I that's important to me, whether it's in the southeast or the southwest. And so, you know, it's one of these judgment calls that it's difficult. The information's out there, albeit slightly not dialed in entirely with regard to the 70-30 versus the 500 or the 75, whatever, 25. But the so I'm influenced by that. I feel that the that there's value in having additional opportunity in the Snake River. That area is, as Commissioner Baker indicated, kind of at, if not the end of the line, it's close to it. And so there's a consideration of getting fish back there and having those areas be able to take advantage of the fisheries. So I'm inclined to support the motion or the amendment to the motion.
Any other further discussion? I'll call for a question regarding the motion on the amendment to the motion. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
Motion carries. Okay, we are now back to the back to the main motion. Commissioner Thorburn first, then you, Bob, and then Dave, it looks like. Commissioner Thorburn, Commissioner Kehoe, and then Commissioner Graybill, please.
I wanted to thank Don for his overview and a return to the proposed amendment to the original draft under the fishery specific provisions, and the language that's been added we've heard so much in testimony about Gillnet specifically as non-selective and not appropriate for these fisheries. And I think this language, I see this as giving our staff the tools that they need to accomplish both the allocation and economic goals of this policy. What I appreciate in the language is it talks about the goal of selectively harvesting healthy hatchery and wild stocks while protecting weak stocks and minimizing bycatch. And I think so often when we talk about selective gear, especially in the commercial fisheries, that we tend to put both the issue of minimizing bycatch and the protecting weak stocks all in one bag. And each of these gears accomplishes one or the other in different ways. And that's been the problem with finding, part of the problem with finding alternatives. And I think that it's very important to acknowledge that when we're talking about selectivity, that it is two really different pieces. One is the target fish, which with marked selective fisheries, principally in the sport fishing, but also the use of tangle nets in the spring Chinook fishery when that happens. We're talking about the target, selectivity of the target fish and protecting those weak stocks. Very often in the testimony we'd hear about gill nets, they'd bring up bycatch. And I know that we've heard a lot of testimony that it's inaccurate to say that they're selective by time, area, and mesh size. They are bycatch selective by time, area, and mesh size. And in that sense, they can be an effective tool in managing, including the conservation concerns of these fisheries. So I appreciate this language. I am supportive of a policy changes as well, but I wanted to highlight that particular piece of the language.
Commissioner Kehoe, then Commissioner Graybill.
Yeah, let me know if my audio breaks up. I do have a statement that I would like to read. I typically don't like to do this, but I wanted to make sure that I got all of my thoughts out and expressed kind of my reasons for supporting the main motion. So, thank you for indulging me, Mr. Chair, and I'll just. So I will be voting in favor of the motion and offer the following comments on why I strongly support the proposed improvements to the policy. One of the guiding principles of the original Columbia River policy, C-3620, was to enhance, or at a minimum, maintain the economic well-being and stability of the Columbia River fisheries, both commercial and recreational. The results of the comprehensive evaluation of the policy published in November of 2018 show that the policy resulted in a decrease in the annual number of angler trips to mainstem fisheries downstream of Bonneville Dam compared to the pre-policy period, despite a slight increase in the total number of fishing days. On the other hand, the policy resulted in dramatic decrease in the ex-vessel value of the commercial fisheries. A key component of the policy was to shift the commercial harvest from 2/3 coming from the mainstem Columbia and 1/3 from the few side off-channel sites referred to as select areas, and flipping that division of harvest. The policy and its Oregon complement, the Kitzhaber Plan, called for 2/3 of the commercial harvest to come from select areas and the other 1/3 from alternative fishing gear. The successful development of select areas and alternative gear were both necessary for the policy to work. Neither occurred. First, the attempt to increase production in the select areas to generate the same amount of returning adult salmon and value to make up for the loss of commercial harvest from the main stem has proven to be unsuccessful, particularly in Washington, where there are no select areas. Deep River select area was shut down shortly after the policy was implemented because of poor returns to the hatchery. Similarly, the planned Cathlamet Channel select area never opened because of extremely poor hatchery. Second, the policy was dependent upon discovering, testing, and establishing the viability and feasibility of a new seine fishery or some other unknown potential harvest method to replace gill nets in the main stem. For many reasons, the seine fishery has not been successful for the specific purposes intended under the policy. The mortality rates of ESA-listed stocks encountered in the seine fishery were unacceptably high. These mortality rates are much higher than what was assumed when the policy was developed. In addition, the encounter of ESA-listed steelhead in the seine gear is much higher than what was assumed. While the survival rate of steelhead encountered in the seine gear is favorable, the high encounter rate results in unacceptably high number of steelhead mortalities. The high mortality rate of wild Chinook stocks and the high steelhead encounter rate make the use of seine gear in the main stem impractical both biologically and economically. Given the inability to significantly increase hatchery production for harvest in the select areas and the absence of a biologically accepted, viable, or economically effective alternative fishing gear to commercially harvest fish in the main stem, the ex vessel value of the commercial fishery collapsed as documented in the comprehensive review. When the commission adopted the policy, it fully recognized that the policy was premised on many unknowns, and the policy further called for the commission to take corrective action if the policy did not work as expected. In the general policy statement, the policy states as follows. There is uncertainty in the presumptive path forward, including the development and implementation of alternative selective fishing gear, securing funding for enhanced hatchery production, and the expansion or development of off-channel fishing areas. Consequently, the Commission recognizes that management decisions in the transitional period and subsequent years must be informed by fishery monitoring, both biologic and economic, and may be modified as necessary to meet the stated purposes. Well, the uncertainty has come to pass and has become certainty because neither of these key elements of the policy has been achieved. As Commissioner McIsaac pointed out in his remarks, the proposed changes to the policy address many important issues other than the sport commercial allocation that were not contained in the original policy, such as the additional guiding principles calling for the department to advocate for salmon and steelhead habitat protection and recovery, as well as increased hatchery production in a manner that avoids adverse impacts to wild salmon and steelhead populations. These new guiding principles are expected to result in increased salmon and steelhead returns to the Columbia in the long term, which will benefit all users of the resource. The proposed changes also include a renewed commitment to the development and implementation of alternative fishing gear by providing incentives to commercial fishermen to use their ingenuity in developing such gear and innovative fishing techniques. Other proposed additions to the policy that are positive in my view are the general provisions that call for the department to prioritize scientific monitoring of commercial and recreational fisheries and spawning escapements. And this morning we heard a representative for Trout Unlimited comment regarding steelhead release mortality in commercial fisheries and the need to further study that. Another positive is the addition of the general provision calling for the research and development of thermal angling sanctuaries to protect migrating salmon and steelhead during warm water conditions. You heard Mr. Moskowitz from the Conservation Angler group strongly advocate for this to be included in the policy. And you know, lastly, turning to the issue of allocation, the proposed changes are consistent with the intent of the original policy to provide a sport priority for Chinook salmon. The abundance-based approach for spring and summer Chinook provides the vast majority of allowable ESA impacts to the recreational fishery in years of low abundance and provides for increased commercial opportunities in years of high abundance. While some commercial interests correctly point out that the economic analysis of the proposed abundance-based approach shows the ex-vessel value of the commercial fishery will be less than it was pre-policy, the expectation is that the proposed new guiding principles and general provisions I mentioned will result in larger returns to the Columbia, which will improve the economics of both the commercial fishery and the recreational fishery in the long term. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I would urge my colleagues to join me in voting yes on the motion. And finally, last but not least, I'd like to recognize my colleagues on the Columbia River Work Group, Commissioner McIsaac, his tireless efforts in kind of shepherding the group through, as well as Commissioner Graybill. We spent a lot of time together. We learned a lot. We shared our views and in a collegial, collaborative effort. And I think that's what this is all about. And then finally, I'd like to recognize staff, Ryan and Bill Twight. Ryan, you're too young to know the term, but I called you the hardest working man in show business. And that is completely appropriate. That refers to the rock and roll icon, soul, James Brown. The term fits very well with you, sir. And also Bill Twight for your wisdom and guidance through this process. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Commissioner Keogh. Commissioner Graybill.
Thank you, Chair Carpenter. And thank you for the comments, Commissioner Kehoe and Commissioner McIsaac. You know, I am opposed to this policy. I want to be clear that there are a lot of positives to this, that the policy does reiterate the commitment to the buyback program, to research on alternative gear. It recognizes the importance of cold water refuges. And we've talked about climate change as an issue. So there's a lot of positives that have resulted in the work that's been applied to developing this draft policy. However, I think there are some real critical flaws that do run contrary to our commitments to conservation. The idea of having a main stem gillnet fishery pre-run update, I consider irresponsible. This is before we even know if we're going to get our fish back. The last two seasons, it's been downgraded. We have no reason to believe that it's going to improve. The 10-year average for spring Chinook is 174,000. We had 55,000 last year. And so to add another layer on top of pinniped, avian, climate change, pike minnow predation, now we're going to add gillnets even prior to the main stem river, even prior to a run update, I'm very much opposed to, and to introduce that during the post-run update. This is when the Upper Columbia spring salmon are present in the river. These are mixed stocks. There's no way to sort them out. They will be taken, and they are in serious, serious jeopardy. This was pointed out by Bill Twight in last April, and we've brought it up again and again. They have set off triggers with NOAA. They are in very serious trouble. And we have to make efforts to improve their condition, not potentially make it worse. And these actions by introducing main stem gillnet fisheries in the spring put them in further jeopardy. That's really important to me, and should be to anyone that's concerned about these fisheries. The same is true for the summer. By adding another layer, another obstacle to recovery of our upper Columbia steelhead is putting gillnets in the river at that time when they're moving through the system. They are right behind upper Columbia spring salmon in terms of jeopardy. We're seeing the fourth lowest in history returns on upper Columbia steelhead. And again, to add another layer of challenge to that is not appropriate at this time. We should, our concern should be primarily, as Larry Cassidy said, primarily for the resource, and everything else is secondary. I also wanted to point out that I thought that Commissioner McIsaac, you mentioned that in 2019 and 2020, Oregon met us in terms of concurrency. Actually, we met Oregon's rule in both cases. And I brought this up in March when, in February, that we are going to see the same thing. The fisheries would be executed the same they were, way they were in 2019. And that is absolutely true. I want to continue to offer, I'm sorry, Barbara Baker, that I've introduced an amendment that may put a wrinkle in our concurrency, but what I've introduced is very minor compared to what's being proposed in this draft policy, particularly for spring salmon and summer salmon in terms of being concurrent with Oregon. We're in an impossible position. I think this commission needs to be aware we have a long way to go, and I really think that we're in for a difficult time reaching concurrency with Oregon with the proposed policy that we have today. I hope you all got the letter that I issued. I'm not going to go into it in great depth, but I wanted to make those points as my particular concerns, again, are with spring salmon and summer salmon, and having that challenge now of navigating gillnets in the main stem river on top of the other challenges that we face for recovery of those particular species.
Thank you, Commissioner Graybill. Commissioner Baker, and then, but I don't know, am I going to get a turn, Commissioner McIsaac? I'll let you go after Commissioner. But I've got about 24 sheets of comments here. Commissioner Baker, then Commissioner McIsaac, and then maybe me. I don't know.
Chair Carpenter, I'm happy to follow you if you want to insert yourself.
Well, I'm taking a break now. I'll let McIsaac go first, and then we'll go forward. I'll be fairly boring, I'm sure. So go ahead, Don.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd be glad to defer and come after you as well. Mine will be very quick, though, if you want me to go first. Let me say that I would comment on two things. A pre-update fishery being dangerous on the spring Chinook matter, and adding a gillnet fishery being a conservation problem in a pre-update fishery or on a summer Chinook fishery. So this seems to rely on a perception that having a gillnet fishery is a dangerous thing. It also sets aside the new direction in there for the Columbia River Compact seat to pick the most selective gear, which would be a tangle net and not a gill net in the spring, unless we're at a really big run size or the Willamette River run is big or something. It's not going to happen anytime real soon, I don't think. So is it dangerous to have a fishery in there where it could explode and go beyond the 30% buffer and cause a problem? And I think we talked to the staff about that earlier, and when I'm done, I would ask Ryan Lothrop to answer the question about whether the fishery can be managed by number of drifts or number of days, or whether the experience of a early gillnet fishery is a very dangerous thing, or whether abundance is so low that no, it's not really that dangerous. But you know, if it really was that dangerous, then I would wonder about the same thing for the sport fishery. And so if it's dangerous to fish before the update with the commercial gear, that I'm under the impression, based on the work group discussions with the staff, is not any more dangerous than a 1,000 boat fleet fishing on April 13th, we shouldn't have. If it's that dangerous, we shouldn't have either. But if you really think those fisheries are going to blow over the 30% buffer, then you're going to take away the Low River sport fishery. Because if you wait until after the update, which is drifted now until mid-May, then the run is by the Lower River, and the economics would just be devastating to the sport fishery to apply this common standard to both before the run size update. This run size update with a buffer of 30% came out of our U.S. v. Oregon process. It was scrutinized with a microscope by the tribal folks who had seen in other years the run size having not materialized and hurting their fishery. So when they looked at a 5% buffer, a 20% buffer, a 50% buffer, a 75% buffer, and all the rest, they came up with a 30% buffer. And this is something that met a multi-agency group of scientists scrutiny as something that is safe given the time of year. And so I'm having trouble with the argument that one of the two gears, the one that is not any more explosive than the sport fishery, is the one that should not happen before. And that would be a reason to vote no on the whole policy that has so many good things. So I would just challenge you on that and give you the opportunity to respond to that. And the other part about adding the gillnets as another obstacle for the spring salmon and the summer salmon to get through, like the wall of pinnipeds that used to be at Bonneville Dam, this is an allocation thing where every fish is counted. We're not adding any more fishing gear. The staff has an excellent capacity to watch these fisheries closely. We're not changing the ESA allowed impact to add more fishing pressure. So I'm having trouble understanding how both fisheries operating, either one of them, being more of an obstacle than used to be the case just by changing the allocation formula. The same number of dead fish is going to occur. It's just who catches them. So I'm having trouble understanding those parts of your argument, Commissioner Graybill, and offer a chance to respond.
Mr. Baker, please.
Thank you, Chair Carpenter. Well, okay, so here's where I am on this proposal. As I've stated in earlier meetings, I think we can do better than this, both on a policy and especially on a strategic level. The only thing preventing me from going out on a limb and making a motion to table the vote is that I've been a strong proponent of the no surprises rule, and I'm really not willing to face the ire of fellow commissioners whom I very much respect by violating that rule. But I want to make it clear that it isn't the content of the policy, or at least not specifically, that troubles me, although I do disagree strongly with parts of it. And by the way, do agree with the note on the pre-run update that Commissioner Graybill just raised. But I'm going to try real hard to stay away from talking about the substance, because I don't think we should be voting on the substance today. It's the timing. This is the wrong time for several good reasons to pass this policy. I'd like to make it clear that conservation of wild stocks is my first priority. I noted a few bullets about the Jacob's ladder analysis that we have been subjected to time and time again. And Don, you just referred to it again. It's the question of whether gillnets are selective, and then what the mortality numbers are, and whether a gillnet, gillnet fishery is ever selective, but the numbers that we have on that make it clear to me that I don't see, especially how the language in the amendment that we just adopted, I don't really see how a gillnet fishery could ever be employed in the Columbia if we're talking about using the most selective gear every single time. I'd also like to point out, respecting or discussing Commissioner Kehoe's comments, I'm glad he noted the TU suggestion this morning for an updated mortality study, not on just gillnets, but all nets, and not taking years to do. We need that because the numbers that we get from people who are all experts in the field are wildly divergent. A new rung on the Jacob's ladder is the orca. And what I've been trying to struggle with is with my conservation priority, is that inhibited or increased if we have strongly supported increased hatchery production in part to provide forage for the orca, even if we need to use non-selective gear to catch them. So sometimes when we're trying to figure out how to be conservation minded, we need to agree with something Commissioner Linville has said in other discussions, is that we can't be species specific in this. And maybe that's something that points to having the use of gill nets in the toolbox. But almost done here. Concurrency is my biggest problem with the timing of this proposal. I have asked repeatedly and received no clear answer about how we plan to achieve concurrency with the Oregon policy, when, as far as I can remember, every vote on this issue that we've taken since I've gotten on the commission has incrementally moved us further from there. And I'm very sure that we'd be in a better position with our colleagues to the south if we sat down with them and talked through their thoughts and our thoughts, including Commissioner Graybill's equities thoughts, before we stick our pick in the sand. I came across a statute that I hadn't seen before as I was researching this. And if it's okay with you, Commissioner Carpenter, it's only a one paragraph long statute. So may I read from? Okay. This is RCW 775010. This is a statute that establishes the Columbia River Compact. And the one paragraph is this. And I'm quoting, all laws and regulations now existing or which may be necessary for regulating, protecting, or preserving fish in the waters of the Columbia River or its tributaries over which the states of Washington, Oregon have concurrent jurisdiction shall be made, changed, altered, and amended in whole or in part only with the mutual consent and approbation of both states. So I was thinking about that. And of course the horse is out of the barn on that. We've already deviated from concurrency. And maybe they mean, you know, consecutive decisions. Doesn't mean we have to make the decision at the same time. But the fact is we have to have mutual consent and approbation. And I believe in the spirit of that statute. And I believe we owe them the conversation before we vote. Finally, the backlash, of course, that's the elephant in this room. I've heard several members today or commissioners quote from people who agreed with the position they were trying to set out. If we were talking about substance and we were quoting, there are literally thousands of people and hundreds of organizations who oppose the rule that we're voting on today. We could be quoting until, you know, Christmas. We need to get a clear answer. We need to fine tune our message on this thing and be able to defend our positions much, much, much better than we have to date. And then that's not even talking about the legislature. At the very least, this policy invites legislation. And we've seen in the past the results some of our decisions have made on our funding. I'm more than willing to take that criticism when we have a final policy agreed to with our neighbor to the south, but I don't see any reason at all to take the heat for a policy that isn't final. We don't know how this is going to end up, and yet we may suffer the consequences for it before it does. So that's pretty much what I have to say. I do want to indicate that in terms of substance, there's a lot I like in this policy, and I am well aware that it represents a ton of work on the part of people on the commission who I totally respect, and especially the staff, but I think we could do better and be smarter. And then in summary, I don't like to be forced to vote on this now, but if I must, my vote will be a no, not based on substance, but what I see is very, very, very poor timing.
Okay, maybe I'll get a turn tomorrow. Commissioner Thorburn, and then Commissioner McIsaac.
I don't have my hand up.
You don't? Oh, I'm sorry, that's Commissioner Graybill. And then Commissioner McIsaac.
Oh, thank you, Larry. Yeah. You know, Barbara, I know your concerns about concurrency. And if, in fact, we removed the areas of this policy that would introduce gillnets to the main stem Columbia River in the spring and summer, we'd be 90% there in terms of being able to be concurrent with Oregon. Those are the big ones. And we're not that far apart. We haven't been that far apart in the past. So I wanted to give you that assurance, and that's another reason why I would vote no, because of the distance we've created with what's in this current policy, draft policy. It just creates an incredible hurdle for concurrency. And Commissioner McIsaac, I know you and Commissioner Kehoe have put me on the spot during our workshop discussions about even allowing a recreational fishery pre-run update. And I've always said that if our fisheries are in jeopardy, no one fishes, recreational or commercial. And I believe that the direction this is heading, no one is going to be fishing into the future. I'm trying to protect the resource, which I consider to be a very real threat to a couple of really dwindling resources that we have in the Columbia River that may prove to be constraining stocks, not unlike we face in the Stillaguamish. Unless we do something now, we could be in serious trouble in the future.
Okay. Thank you, Commissioner Graybill. Commissioner McIsaac.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You're definitely in a position of wanting to back clean up here. So I will let you hear. Let me just make two comments here on Commissioner Baker's perspectives. I think it's good that we all make an informed decision on this that is informed by all the facts. So when Commissioner Baker, you mentioned that you were wondering why there would ever be a gillnet fishery at all in the Columbia River if the standard is that it has to be a selective fishing gear, it makes me think that you think gillnets are always non-selective. And we've asked the staff about that, and their answer has been consistent, that you can be selective by time, area, and mesh situations. And you can't, a gillnet is not selective when it comes to a 10-pound fish that has an adipose fin or not an adipose fin. It is not selective. It is highly selective if you're fishing in a different time when some of those non-target fish aren't present, or a different mesh size, such as what we heard in public testimony today and had a couple of commissioners go out and observe for themselves, or a different area. Time and area and mesh does make it a selective fishery, a tool to use. It doesn't mean that they're non-select, that there are selective toward fish of the same size. That's not true. A cut plug herring being trolled around with two hooks is non-selective for hatchery and wild Chinook, and at buoy 10, you'll catch coho the same way. If some group said the sport fishery is non-selective, it could technically maybe be true under the water, but when it gets inside the boat, the fish are released and it is selective. So there's a lot of playing around with words, but we need to have the gillnet fishery as a tool in the toolbox because we need the commercial fishery to survive and transition to a better, more selective combination of gears so that when it comes around for hatchery decisions to be made by the federal government and the PHAS thing becomes a critical thing, if there is not a commercial fishery around, all of the analysis has shown the sport fishery does not have the fishing power to make the difference in PHAS. And so what are you going to do if you only have a sport fishery and you have a PHAS problem? You're going to lose the hatchery production. That's what's going to happen. So we need a combination of things to move forward in the future. And so I think it's important to understand that gillnets, when people say gillnets are not selective ever, that's just not true. They are not selective in certain situations, but so is a sport fish. So the other thing is, what about our concurrency situation and the timing of this? So my opinion has been that if we reach a position, we can sit down with Oregon and we can talk with them, and with appropriate compromises, we can get somewhere. They've suspended their position and don't know for sure what their position is based on the evaluation because they haven't taken it up. It might be the same as it is right now, or maybe it might not be. We don't know. In previous discussion on this very question, a wise commissioner said, you can't sit down and negotiate with the other side if you don't even know what your position is. And that's what today's vote is about. We need to isolate what is a position for a new policy so that we can go talk to Oregon and initiate these discussions. If we don't, what do we say when we go meet them? We're standing on an old policy that has been shown to need to be fixed. How long does that go on? I think we've heard a lot of business here and a lot of people have said it's time to fish or cut bait on this and move forward. If we don't, we're going to put this right back into the same cauldron and continue to have it come up over and over again. So that's why I think the timing is that we've got to start this process. And the first part is to isolate our position to begin the discussions. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Whose hand is up there now? Is that?
That would be mine.
Okay, go ahead, Commissioner Graybill.
Briefly, and again, this addresses Commissioner Baker's concern and concurrence. Something that you should be aware of, and you may be, is that the Oregon folks, they still have an endorsement program in Oregon. As you know, and quite a bit, one of the reasons we lost our endorsement up here was the Columbia River policy debate. In Oregon, it's even more vital in that the endorsement paid for by sport anglers actually pays for a significant part of the production for the safe areas that the commercials use. And so they really, the debate is even more fierce down there, and the reasons to protect that endorsement is even more important, well, now that we don't have one here any longer. So wasn't sure if you were aware of that, but it's something that they're trying to protect. And again, with dramatic changes in policy, that would be difficult to do.
Okay. Thank you, Commissioner Griddle. I'll be a little more brief than I was going to be, but I don't want to get deep into this, Don, but in a meeting we had with Director Meltzer not long ago, matter of fact, on the 3rd, he spoke very, very candidly and with great certainty about how much more efficient the recreational fleet is and how many more fish they can catch when they're given an opportunity. And I asked the question, why do we keep hearing that as it relates to PHAS, the recreational fishermen cannot help that issue because they don't have the horsepower to catch the fish. So which way is it? I think that's an important issue to determine. So that I just wanted to respond to that. I got just a couple of things to go over here. I want to talk a little bit about selective fishing and what we have in this state. We have the coastal troll fishery. That's selective. We have the Puget Sound, San Juan Island purse seine fishery that Commissioner Kehoe is the executive director of, that they fish selectively. When they're fishing for sockeye or pinks, they have to release Chinook and Coho and Chum. We also have the reef net fishery up in the San Juan Islands, and we have the recreational fishery. I'm going to just tell you categorically, then I'm going to give you a little bit of background. Not that you're going to care, but I'm going to be honest with you anyway. Gill nets are not selective. I grew up doing it. I did it till I was in my 40s. I'm sorry, all the people that feel strongly that they are. I could give you examples more than you want to hear about. I think, and so it's real short-sighted, I think, to take a position that's going to put us in such jeopardy with Oregon as it relates to concurrency. And so from that perspective, I agree with Commissioner Baker on her position. But I want to give you a little more background here. I grew up on the banks of the Skagit River many years ago. And it was on a place called the Dyke Road, and that was because it had a dike on it. And we'd go over the dike and we'd fish off the bank for different species. But when I was 6 years old, I started gill netting. I started gill netting at the mouth of the Skagit and Skagit Bay in the San Juan Islands with my uncle, with my godfather, and my great-grandfather who immigrated from Norway and built the boats out of cedar planks. It was quite an experience for a youngster. And then after college in the military, I moved back to Skagit County and I started a business or two and was totally involved for many, many years in the fishing industry, commercial and recreational. I built Crystal Bay gill net boats. I built deck gear, reels, fair leads. I had a patent on a herring shaker for shaking herring out of a gill net. I spent lots of years up north, 9 years, I think, commercial fishing in Bristol Bay out of Nooshigak and Naknek and Igigik. So I've seen a lot of gill netting, probably 300 or 400 days in my life. Folks, the gill net will catch whatever's in its way and will fit in the net. And even if they don't fit in the net, they will get their teeth wrapped around the net. Now, I'm not against commercial fishing. I think it's an important piece of industry in this state, and the culture and heritage is really, really important. But I just don't think we can have non-selective gill nets. If we're going to go forward, if we're going to go forward in a sustainable way, we have to do better. We have to do better and have gear that is truly selective. We just can't keep kicking the can down the road. That's a term that I say a lot and I hear a lot. But that's what this does. And what it's going to do with Oregon, what it's going to do with the legislature, perhaps, I think is very damaging. So I guess I would support Barbara Baker's suggestion of a timeout. And let's see if we can't get this a little more right. I appreciate all the work that has gone into it. But from my perspective and my life's experiences, I think it's a bigger problem than it is a solution. That's all I have to say.
Call for the question. Mr. Chairman, you're muted.
Okay, I'm going to call for the question. We're going to do this as a roll call because I want people to know. I can't make sense of what the vote's going to be unless people identify what their vote is. Commissioner Kehoe.
Yes.
Commissioner Linville.
Yes.
Commissioner McIsaac.
Yes.
Commissioner Smith.
No.
Commissioner Anderson.
Aye.
Let's see. Commissioner Grayville.
No.
Commissioner Thorburn.
Yes.
I'm sorry, will you repeat that?
Yes, aye. Yes.
Did I miss anybody, Nikki?
Barbara.
Commissioner Baker. Oh, Commissioner Baker. Pardon me, yes.
No.
Good. Okay. What's the tally, Nikki? Did you get that?
Yes, I've got 5 yeses, 4 noes.
My vote would be a no.
Yes, I have you guys no.
Okay, motion carries.
Okay. Mr. Chairman?
We are... Commissioner McKaysey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We haven't decided on what to do about meeting in Oregon, and I would like to also add that we do need to have a very strong communication plan to explain vote to folks. It includes things that were on the record and includes a news release that we learned from our situation from March of 2019, a good strong news release that goes out in a very prompt period of time. And after that, I think a lot of the folks who have not heard some of the things on the record deserve to hear some of this in writing. And in the next 2 weeks, we ought to strive to try to do something that we can show to them and to show to our colleagues over in the state of Oregon.
Okay. I don't think we need to take up the commission's time today to do that. We can do that while we're not in session. We have a lot of other business to do. Any disagreement with that? Okay. We're now going to move to...